Joe's mind, I know that Mr. Gumede has specific issues related to performance auditing. He's not here at the moment. If we could just skip that for a while and then just move on to employment equity and broad-based black economic empowerment. Because I know Don had a specific interest in okay. All right, Mr. Steve, that's on page 28 now. Mr. Nene, Mr. Stevens, did you put your hand up? Who else put your hand up? Mr. Nene put his hand up, didn't you?
Yes.
Yes, you did. And then Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Chair. But I certainly will start with commending the way the organization put an effort. Although there are some areas which we would like to get some clarity. You see, we saw that in terms of employment equity and the target groups as well, and there are areas of concern. Especially when it comes to the disability. So wherever you go, you find that there is an outcry of disability people that they are saying that it seems as if they are neglected. Same as here, you find that it's not properly addressed. We don't know, maybe it's because of the makeup of skin. That's why I'm saying that we need to clarify there. And again, when you saw there, even that 4.6%, it seems as if it's only made. So we'd like to get a clarity there. Thank you.
Mr. Stevens?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think you've done exceptionally well, especially as far as gender equality is concerned. Because as I understand the figure 3 on page 28, and I must say I'm not entirely clear, because you say, for example, that non-targeted groups are 16%. Now, that is a euphemism for saying white. But non-targeted group. But I see the two columns. The male and the female columns are each marked 16%. But since the total is 16%, I assume that in fact white males is 8% and white females is 8%. Or do I not understand this thing correctly? Because you can't add the two 16% together. And then by the same token, I see the real rise has been amongst African employees. Coloured employees, no change whatsoever. And Indians have in fact gone down from 6.5% to 4.4%. And disabled, as my colleague has pointed out, is all male. So except for the disabled, the gender equality seems to be there, but not no advances as far as colours and Indians are concerned. In fact, a slide as far as Indians are concerned. But the other thing that also concerns me again is the budgeting. Because if you have a target of 80-20, one wonders on what basis did you originally target that. Was it only because you thought that would be achievable, or did you think that that was the correct balance? Because if you overshoot a target like you've done there, 84%, 84-16 versus the target at 80-20, then one doesn't really know whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. Because if 84-16 is better than 80-20, it seems like 100-0 would then be the best. Surely that can't be the intention. That's not the intention. What is the actual target? What is your eventual point that you want to reach, targeted versus non-targeted groups? I can't imagine that your target for that the aim for non-targeted groups is 0%, if that's what you're aiming at. So one would like to know what you actually want to achieve as far as a balance is concerned, or whether you're going to thereafter just leave it to circumstances of the state whoever you're going to employ, depending on who's available and the skills that you need. And that you've basically from 80-20 onwards, you're not engineering the thing. Because to have 50-50, for example, on gender is clearly an engineered result, because the good Lord hasn't got to that state yet where he has one boy born for every one girl born. So you're way ahead of the good Lord there. But thank you. I'd like to have an idea of what you have in mind. Thank you.
Let me start with the disability numbers first. There is a project that's currently underway by the Employment Equity team to look specifically on the strategy for dealing with the disability situation in the office. This was established with the realization that as an audit practice, we cannot have an undefined disability criteria for the kind of work that we do. So that project is meant to then define what kind of disability criteria we should consider in order to address this in a more systematic manner. That exercise should be finished in a few months from now. And then once that's done, and I hope that it will be part of the strategy plan that is coming, then we think we can have an indication as to where and how we're going to work towards the disability targets. The figures that are here are basically a stroke of luck, a stroke of whatever. They're not driven by any particular strategy that has been defined by the office. That is still underway. Yeah. However, with regard to the race and the gender split, there is a much more defined target there that is based on clearly recessed information, which was used to base our 80-20 target that we did establish. I think the fact that we have overshot it would in a way be an indication of the effort that has been put. I say that because when we put the 80-20 target, it was an average target that was based on overcompensation on the training side and overcompensation on the management side. And both overcompensation were to the wrong extremes. On the management side, you've got an overcompensation if you go to base 32, those circles. We still have a high number of representation of professionals that are still white male. But because the numbers are small there, on average, it comes back to it still works out within the 80-20. And therefore, if we do better in that area, it will have the natural effect of that overshooting of the target overall. Where the target should end up at, then again, there's a clear number that we put in the strategy plan that 80-20 should be the minimum. I don't think we've defined what the cutoff should be beyond 80-20, because at the moment we're still struggling to actually get the numbers right at the management level. Although at the training level, the numbers are more or less where they should ideally be. Because those numbers for the trainees are a true representation of the demographics of the country. Based on the research that has been done. So that's the base of the numbers at the moment. I don't know, Kimi, in terms of the latest search plan, whether there's a thought to revise those numbers, but from the previous medium plan, there was no intention to move from 80-20 up until 2010.
Just to add to that, we still are planning to keep the 80-20 split. I think the key focus for us going forward is to focus on building a qualitative 80-20, for want of a better word, whereby from time to time the numbers of people coming through our environment because of the nature of the training contract come in and over a very short space of time are gone. And from within that base of training accountants, we are focusing on driving issues of retention and to start growing our leadership from within. So I think largely, whether the number will change to 75 in reality, but I think largely that split of 80-20 will be there. But we think that where the big challenge is and where we are losing on issues of continuity is because we are not able to retain people who have learned and grown in the environment. And a large number of those are black because of the profile of our training accountant ranks. We train them, and after 3 years, they go and work elsewhere. And we lose out on issues of quality, we lose out on issues of cost of auditing, amongst other things, because the investment in the early years in their training, particularly, you know, the young ones who also qualify as CA, we lose that out of our environment. Well, when they are starting to mature into the auditing environment after spending 3 years of training accountants, that's when we lose them. So effectively, we certainly think that it's the right approach to this, to say from within the ranks of those 84% of our staff, we need to be developing our management capacity from there. Because the potential is there, it's just that the focus has not necessarily been on that. So the numbers in terms of 80-20 and 84-16, yes, look like we're making progress. But I think if one drills down into the qualitative aspect of the makeup of that, you've got a predominantly white senior management within that environment, and that's the balance that needs to be struck over the next years. Because we've also lost quite a lot of experience as well in terms of people who've been in the system for some time, and we'd like to utilize what those that are there to make sure that we benefit from the insights that have developed over the years.
Eddie, you wanted to add something?
Yes. I think my question has largely been answered by the latter part of the... But I just wanted to... Could you give us some idea, because I mean, clearly this is a problem... with affirmative action is the fact that black trainees, accountants, lawyers, whatever, professional people are in great demand in the private sector. What percentage of your trainees are you losing, which is difficult to give us?
In percentage terms, I certainly wouldn't be able to give you an accurate number, but the interesting aspect is those that have left are, without being prompted, coming back and calling us for opportunities to work in this environment in management. So I think what I've seen over a period of time, there's a time when they move out into the private sector and they realize sometimes that the grass is probably more browner than they thought. And they start engaging us in terms of, you know, opportunities for coming back. And I think also the visibility of the office in terms of various things that it does makes those that were in our environment before to want to try it out. Quite frankly, I think the percentages are largely within the trainee accountant ranks, and once they move into the management rank, they don't spend a lot of time there growing into your business executives as well as your senior manager. So we still have a challenge to pull people from within and grow them into the
business.
Thank you. Any
Just of interest, is there any effort within the industry that seeks to bring about a strategy that works towards growing such numbers? To an extent, such a strategy could even include government. Is there any concerted effort that seriously... Because I would imagine there are a number of initiatives, you know, from Tutuka and there are a few others. Is there any way where you pull all of these resources together to say, here we have these targets,
as an industry, specifically on the sector wherein we need to achieve this much result within a set period of time.
Can I just respond quickly to that? I think the where the coordination is happening is through Tutuka, as you have mentioned, and the main focus there is to grow what is called the pipeline of people in the system. This is unofficial, but there's been a recent session by the trustees of Tutuka in which we are also represented, and the vice chancellors of the universities about a month ago to deal with that question specifically, because that's where the bottleneck is. There may be a lot of people that potentially could come into the system, but the universities themselves don't have sufficient capacity to absorb all the people. Because the phenomenon I'm picking up now is that all the firms put together, especially the big firms, don't have the numbers that they need in order to train the accountants because of the shortage at varsity level. And hence the meeting with the vice chancellor to deal with that issue. Out of that meeting, there were very interesting commitments which will culminate into involving the Department of Education, Science and Technology, especially from the math point of view, to have a joint effort on the math promotion at school level. So there are those initiatives that are taking place. But they can only take place if there's coordination and cooperation within the profession, and one believes that the Tutuka platform is the right platform to deal with that issue, and that is happening.
Any questions relating to Black economic empowerment?
Madam Chair, just one area. I think the work that has been done through this report, it shows the commitment and probably I would say the success. But the test of the success would be for me to check as to what the quality. Do you get the qualities of service provided from that engagement?
Mr. Chen?
Yeah, some of the CCD itself. And I just wondered whether you could, before we move on from staff,
we have discussed this retention strategy, you know, in bits and pieces, and I think we've got a good idea, but maybe, you know, the statement was made by Terence in his report where he said that they've set 207, 208 aside to address the high staff turnover rate by reviewing the policies relating to staff retention, etc. Do you have a specific policy which is spelled out with goals, deadlines, you know, whatever, or is it just general interventions that you undertake? Because to me, the retention is, as you said, especially when you're getting people into the management levels within the office, it becomes very important to have that institutional memory and experience. Especially as you are losing people with experience every year, I'm sure, to retirement, etc. So do you have a specific plan, you know, detailed plan, or was it just certain ad hoc intervention?
I might clear, Chair, that we, as part of our ongoing engagement with this issue, have come up with a plan internally in the office which talks to, amongst other things, skill transfer. It's still at its embryonic stages. What it attempts to do, and we've done some initial research within the organization to find out what are the reasons people leave. And most of those issues are around, I don't think I'm getting enough exposure, I'm not getting enough experience in this environment for me to increase the opportunities for future employability. That has stood out for me as one of the major issues standing out. It's not so much to do with how much one earns. It's got a lot to do with people wanting to know that does this environment make it possible for me to still be relevant in the job market in the future. And what we said was that maybe as an initial target is to talk to some of our very experienced people, predominantly within the ranks of very senior white managers, to start developing a process within the organization where, amongst other things, there's going to be a dilution of recoverable time in relation to the time they spend doing mentoring internally. And that's one area where we started developing some thinking and has actually produced a document which is still within our ranks from a discussion point of view. We're still discussing with how we want to implement it. But the starting point was to say we have within our own environment institutional memory that gets lost over a period of time. Whereas in fact, if we had a clear program dedicated around the issue of skill retention, those that are within our environment will see a lot more opportunities when they grow in that environment and become professional auditors in government. We haven't had that, I think, for some time. If it happens, it happens by virtue of somebody being involved in audits. But there's a lot of other things that they never get exposure to until they get into levels of management. So we are trying to bring that forward, whereby if we identify a corporate executive, for example, who's nearing retirement within a defined period of time, we want him to say maybe it's time that that corporate executive focuses less and less on core audit delivery, but make sure that they mentor and grow our people from within and become an example with them so that those people will become the accomplices to those corporate executives when they go out and meet at audit committees. Get those trainee accountants to be the ones who are leading the discussions within the audit committee meeting so that if they make mistakes, at least they are making them in the process of learning rather than having to find themselves standing alone in a high-powered audit committee without anybody standing back to assist them. So there's a number of issues we've identified initially within our human capital environment and some of the interventions that we need to bring into the environment. It's going to be a challenge because we're going to need to persuade people to free up that time and venture into areas where they have not ventured before. But we think that there's a sense that we might be able to make some gains in that area.
I'm surprised and pleasantly surprised that the fact the salaries didn't really become an issue, which means you're probably paying at a level that is not totally unrelated.
Yeah,
I thought that was going to be your answer.
Well, it's more in the order of priority of issues, I think, but certainly it does feature at the top in terms of the totality of issues, but in the priority, I think a lot of people are saying, I'm sitting here, I'm spending 3 to 4 years, I don't think I'm gaining the experience that is deserving of a chartered accountant in a position like I'm in, because if I compare myself to somebody who's at Investec with the same profile as me, that person is probably at a level different to where I am. So I think those are the issues, I think, especially within the younger generation. But certainly I think issues also are from time to time to come up. I wouldn't downplay them, but I thought in order of priority.
And perhaps just to round that one up, that we've mentioned many examples, I mean, including the one that Kutini just mentioning. And all that is or will be incorporated in the HR strategy, which has been the focus of the HR unit in the past few months since that unit was actually established. Their first task was to come up with the human resource strategy that will address the current challenges we have. Challenges similar to the ones we reflected upon before lunch, when we struggled to talk about them because they were in the public eye.
Now, the one question that Mr. McLeod has heard, the answer to that, and that is a question of quality and contract.
Regarding the contract work issues in terms of, I guess in a sense the question about do we get value for the money we pay the contractors, in a sense. You have to do monitor that in two ways. One is the actual assessment in terms of the quality of the audit technical work. And that's why that is part of one of the allocation criteria when it comes to allocating work to the firm. It weighs 30% for now, as stated in page 29. But the other one, which is less formalized, is the through the reputation index in the survey, where we actually get feedback from stakeholders as to what their experiences are about the firms that attend there. There's a lot of valuable information that we get out of that in terms of the understanding of the business, the readiness to actually operate in a public sector. And we're acting on most of those because there's a lot that is coming back that says, in instances where you send firms, we find that the understanding of the business is not at an ideal level. That's the case for us as well, where we send new trainees. But it's something that we are mindful of and we're acting on. So those are the two ways in which we actually monitor the extent to which we get value for the money that's paid to the firm.
Thank you, Chair. Just two little matters. The first is that on your leadership development and further training and that type of action that you take, especially if you mention something like Investec, they tend to have a lot of their people send them on MBA courses for which they pay. I don't know if that is of any value to you, but that is one of the things I think that an employee would look at, is what are the chances of being given opportunity to do an MBA through your office. Is it there? Secondly, I just have a small heads up on the triple BEE, because you say the target is 100% compliance with criteria. Actual performance is 100% compliance with criteria for contract work and all centralized procurement. That sort of raises the question, are there other criteria then that you do not meet? Why do you limit your compliance to contract and centralized procurement, but your target is 100% compliance? Maybe nothing, but it just gives me a head up. Why is it, it seems qualified, 100% on the...
Yes, it is a qualified 100%, because the triple BEE legislation goes beyond just what we are doing. And you recall that in the strategic plan we did say that with the introduction of the triple BEE legislation, we need to revise our current procurement practices in line with that. So that's the work that's currently underway. But while that is underway, we wanted to measure ourselves on what matters the most for the office. And what matters the most for the office is the work that we dish out to the firms in order to contribute towards the transformation of the profession. And if you look at the bulk of our procurement, this is 80% of our procurement comes through contract work. This is what spend, I mean, 300 million, which is close to 30% of our entire budget. So that's why, in terms of the economy of scale, that's where, if we do things right, we need to do it here. So that's why it's qualified to say, whatever targets are set here, whatever guidelines are set for the allocation, we need to meet them 100%, because if we don't, then we get another outcry from the stakeholders in terms of the unfair treatment and preferential treatment. So that's why we did not want to be exposed to that.
Taking any one more question on these two issues. Kenny, did you want to say anything?
No.
Taking the last question because we must move on.
It's related but slightly different. Are you satisfied that your contract, your outsource audits, that they are complying with your standards of reporting? Okay, that's not standards, but the depth of your reporting. I've just been having a look at, right, we haven't had the bulk of the reports coming through yet, but I still get the impression that the audit reports from the outsourced audits compared to those that we get from the Audit General are different, in that they do not raise those issues. They don't raise compliance issues.
at the Auditor General does. Now, I don't know, unfortunately, whether it's because there aren't any issues, but I find it difficult to believe that, you know, the pattern is always the same. It's just like a half a page. Yeah. And that does concern me, because A, we're paying more for those audits, and B, I don't think we're getting the sort of information we want in order to make progress, in getting a more efficient and effective governance, in our country.
That is almost similar, in a way, to the question that Mr. McLava asked.
Yeah.
Can we just have a response to that?
Yes, indeed, that used to be the case in the past. Until such time as we issued the directive on the standards that need to be complied with for the audit, which directives were passed through this committee for comment. Now, what then remains for us to do is to then have an exercise that will check if all the firms that are auditing the public sector have complied fully with the directive here. Where we face a risk there is those firms that don't do work on our behalf but are auditing other public sector institutions. But those that do work on our behalf, they certainly will report in the same way that we report.
Mm.
Because there we've got an audit controller that signs off on the final audit, audit outcome. But for other firms that are just auditing the public entities that you don't have an audit responsibility for, we still need to conduct an exercise to confirm the compliance with the directive, and we may issue a report that will look at those deviations at a later stage.
So if you had audited your own office, would your report have been as clean without emphasis on matter as BDO has given you?
Cheeky, Mr. Dr. Wood.
I would say yes, Chair, because I think no organization can ever have everything done 100%, but it's the significance of those issues that count. And let me just contextualize this. Even departments that have got other matters raised, it is those departments that have got those issues at a level that's beyond an acceptable limit. But every department that audits always has an issue.
Can we just move on? Because really...
Can we assume from now on, if we look at the report, that they are compliant and complying in terms of your standards?
Check to a large extent, yes, they will. Those that we actually have a direct responsibility to audit. But as I said, those that we don't have, we still need to conduct an exercise to confirm that the firms have complied with the directive. Because it was the first time that the issue this year.
Okay. Can we then just move back? We haven't done anything on performance auditing and auditing of performance information. That's on page 26 and 27. Donna, now that you wanted to ask some questions there. Okay.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. In fact, I wanted to my reference is page 26, auditing of performance information, and my other reference is the stretch plan of the Auditor General. My first question is, nothing was reported by the Auditor General for auditing purposes in the which is reflected in the strategic plan as required by section 20(2)(c) and 28(1)(c) of the Public Audit Act. But we have a report here that has the actual report, and that is done, which is therefore budgeted for. Could we get an explanation for that, please?
Is this reference to the Public Audit Act?
The reference to the Public Audit Act is section 20. 22C.
Yes.
20 brackets 2C.
The Auditor General must, in respect of each audit referred to in section, an audit report must reflect such opinions and statements as may be required by any legislation applicable to the auditee, which is the subject of the audit, but must reflect at least an opinion or conclusion on, and one of the things is the reported information relating to the performance of the auditee against predetermined objectives. So that's the information, performance information thing. Now you're asking, where are the milestones of the own Auditor General's report in achieving those outputs? Is that right?
Before the milestones, why is it not in the
strategic plan of previous year?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it is in the strategic plan. What we had not done in the strategic plan was to provide the details, perhaps of what that 100% achievement entails.
I must say it's very difficult to work with this. This is a particularly bad, Mr. Gomez is right, this particular table is does not assist us to evaluate performance much. You know, 100% compliance. Well, I'm very glad you've got 100% compliance, but we don't know with what.
Yes, in fact, my second question was to be just to get an explanation now. How we came to identify these milestones. Is it the actuals that is the projected, or if so, what are these milestones?
Yes.
I think the Blue Book, the strategic plan has got the details of the milestones up until 2010 or so, where we expect to have issued an audit opinion on performance information, same way as BDO has done for us. But for departments, because of their level of readiness, we're doing that in phases. So the milestones are basically saying that until such time as departments are ready to produce this information systematically throughout government, our focus up to now will only be covering audit of performance information as part of the scope of the audit. However, in covering those audits, we will not be issuing an opinion, but we'll be reporting factually on the deviations from the Treasury regulations. And those Treasury regulations, they give guidance as to how departments should report against their strategic plans, against their performance information. And that's all that we're looking for at the moment. Next cycle, we'll be looking at some element of evidence that what they're reporting on is supported by some underlying records. And then eventually in 2010, we're hoping that by then there'll be a standardized reporting framework around this, and in which case we can report factually about compliance fully with that strategic framework, reporting framework rather, by nation that will be prescribed by National Treasury. Now, we do take cognizance of this fact, and in our meeting last year where we looked at the revision of these performance indicators, we have noted that we need to revise the wording of these plans so that they have got some element of clarity and transparency about the nature of the measurements themselves. So in the next strategic plan that is coming, it will also contain specifics around what does 100% represent, where we're still measuring milestones against a target that is yet to come in future. Because there'll be about 3 or 4 of these kinds of measurements which we're still building to achieve in the future.
I want to caution the Auditor General's office. We've now got 2 members of staff here who are frantically taking notes. And so one of my jobs is that I'm going to ask them to please spell out every time that we get told that in the next strategic plan we will get this information and that information, and then we'll send on that list on to you as a double check before you present your strategic plan, so that we can just check against that, just so that we're speaking to the same thing. Okay, carry on.
Yeah, I think I'm done with regard to that, and I think it's a matter that we had already identified in our previous meeting, which we'll be addressing once again in the next third place.
Okay. Are you satisfied that you've covered in your questions, Mr. Gomede?
Yes, for now, yes.
Dr. Woods, you wanted to ask, and then Mr. Kent.
Thank you. In your report, you say that Section 13 of the Act requires that you determine the standards to be applied in performing such audits. But Section 13 also says that you can only determine these standards after consultation with the oversight mechanism. I haven't seen your plan for performance auditing, let alone the standards. I don't know if I've been bypassed or if you have presented them to the Oversight Committee for its consultation. Could you take me out of darkness, please?
It is incorporated in the directive that was issued and which the committee was provided with to comment on. Perhaps you can just assist us there how we did that with Jan, because before we tabled the directive, there would have been a process of consultation with the committee, even before I signed off on that directive. I just need to confirm how that was formalized with the committee, because the directive is now sitting in a gazette form, if I'm not mistaken. And if the firms have got to make reference to that, they will make reference to that gazette, to that directive in a gazette form. So it's a public document that each and every audit firm that audits the public sector has got to make reference to. That exercise, followed the training that took place on the auditing process and auditing standards. But I just lose my memory. It's failing me as to when that was formalized.
Chair, I have a particular interest in this area, and I've been waiting a long time to find out exactly what the auditing of performance information is actually going to entail. And so I wouldn't have missed that very easily.
I think we have been missed out, because I'm just checking with Mr. Peterson here. I know that Jan van Schalkwyk did come and present, but he presented on auditing standards generally, you know, in regulatory auditing. It wasn't on performance auditing. It was just training, more or less. It wasn't a formal consultation process. I wonder if we can just check on this.
I think what we'll do, Chair, we'll check with the Secretariat how that was formalized with the Jan van Schalkwyk. But that information will be incorporated, because there's a certain chapter directives that deals with audit of performance information, how that should be conducted, the scope of it, and how the opinion should be, rather the conclusion should be provided in this area.
This is one serious omission. I stand to be corrected, and I'm asking Mr. Peterson to just double check, but I do not recall receiving any directives on performance auditing, any on the standards of performance auditing. Now, I just want to point out that these lapses in corporate governance are happening just a little bit too frequently, and I could be corrected, and they might have been passed on, they might have been overlooked, so just bear in mind what I'm saying is subject to verification. But you will recall that we, on matters that we were supposed to be consulted on or performed, there have been matters that we haven't been. One was the appointment of the Deputy Auditor General. I think the Corporate Governance Office needs to be a little bit tighter on understanding what issues need to be referred to us, because it's happening a little bit once too often that we're not getting the kind of information we need, that information that we have to make decisions on. And I know that there's a particular interest in our committee around performance information auditing. I would suggest that we have an urgent meeting for this to be presented to us. You'll know the conference of the resolution of the APAC conference was that there'd be a draft performance audit done, the draft methodology presented to APAC people about what performance auditing is about. But I think we need to know, as soon as they give advances, we've got to have it. I also want to say, I think this is one of the critical areas of delivery of the Auditor General's Office, performance information auditing. So it might be that, you already issuing the standards to the profession. Is that right? Places us in a dilemma. When does it go into the Gazette for issuing?
Ideally, you just need to check on the thing. It would have been in the first quarter of the year, before the PFMA audits started.
So
any time between March, April, or May of this year, that's when that was the finalized.
Look, I think that what is those standards that you have issued, they've already been issued in the Government Gazette, is that right? Well, then there's a technical hitch, because they should not be issued without our approval. The standards of the audit, we have to be consulted. The Auditor General, after consulting the oversight mechanism, must determine the standards to be applied in performing audits.
I do agree with you. Perhaps we need to tighten up on our side the method by which we do this issue, because the document that I signed that put those standards into place clearly states, and it's in our records in the office, that was done after consulting the committee. Now, how that was done, because I was not part of that exercise, is what we perhaps need to follow up on here.
Mr. Hulfrecht did come and give us a briefing on auditing standards. It might have been his impression that was a consultation. I think we need to just let our committee secretary here consult with your corporate governance, and let's get that sorted out. If it is the case, you see, I think just Mr. von Skolbeck just presenting to us isn't really giving us time to comment, to digest the document or to comment on it. I think we need to schedule a session pretty soon. And I know that your schedule is very tight at the moment. But I think we must, we will ask the committee secretary and your unit to just schedule a time that we can do this. Okay. I would also want to ask maybe what do you say, Mr. Adil?
I just want to ask that would you certainly leave the plane from Dalton itself?
Yes. Darwood has identified the 11th of May, and he's what he said? He's got the transcription of what took place at that meeting, on his computer. So I think we must just get that sorted out now, or after this meeting. Dr. Woods?
Yeah, to the Darwood and Adil Matapa shares our legal buttons. There might be a technical actually in order to generally, Section 13 refers to
section 11, and we're now trying to cross-reference with section 20, which does begin in 21 by referring to reports as in section 11, but whether that continues into section 2 or 20, I don't know, but it could be an interpretive escape route for you. But even if there is, I would very much, I do think it's in the interest of the committee to familiarize themselves with the methodologies and standards of the report.
Just for those who haven't got the Public Audit Act, I think we just need to verify that the standards that we are meant to be consulted on include performance auditing. Because it might be that those standards, I'm not going to deal with it now because it refers back to that clause, refers back to that clause, back, you know, it's just one of the backward moving clauses. So I think we must just check on that, unless these two could just check up on it. But regardless, I think it would be useful for us just to have a briefing, if not a consultation on this matter. Okay. Well, thanks for raising this. Okay.
Are we talking now about both auditing of performance information and performance auditing?
I think because
they're two different things.
I think for the purposes of this discussion, we are referring to both then, performance information and performance auditing. Am I correct, Mr. Nombembe?
Chair, it's only performance information. Performance auditing standards, we haven't published those widely. We're still consulting within the office to confirm what would be the right standard to actually publish on this side, together with the standard on special investigations. Those two are still circulating within the office. But the one that will be there will be performance information and results audit. That will be the Gazette.
Yeah. Don't know the scope of your yet, how you're going to do performance auditing, then that seems to me, you know, to say about 70%, for example, what can we actually achieve with that 70% if we don't have that in place? What can we do with the amount of money involved? And I welcome the fact that they have said at least in this money, not 70%, at least. And we do understand that we can't really get into this time performance auditing until we've got the question of the auditor's performance information source. So I'm just wondering whether we are going to try and push that figure to that 70% up.
Can I just hold discussion on this? I don't know if you're moving to any radically different position in your strategic plan, are you? Around performance information, performance auditing. That reassures me. I think that we need a broader understanding of where the Auditor General's office is going, given the incredible challenges that are facing us just around regulatory auditing at the moment. But also, there is the statutory injunction for it to move to performance information and performance auditing. I wouldn't want us to tackle this issue at the moment in committee. In when we're looking at the annual report, I think it rightly belongs within your strategic plan. But I think it requires a lot of careful planning, discussion, before we load the Auditor General's office, because it's going to require different kinds of staff, different kinds of auditing, a whole range of things. And if you don't mind, Eddie, if we could just postpone such a discussion for later date.
Yes, sir. Discuss it, but what I wanted to get clarity in, because I think if what Tim said is that amount for performance audit and special audit. Because special audit, you see, because what concerns me is that there's a great deal of value in the special audits. We've seen that. We had quite a number of them now. The housing one comes to mind, where it's something that needs to be done in order to make get improvement and to stop corruption, you know, waste of money and so on. Now, that's not really performance, but it's, and I think I wouldn't like to see those orders being curtailed because of a lack of resources. And the way I understand it, James, most of that money is not recoverable. Unless the department asks you to do it, you can't actually charge them. Is that correct? You do, but they're not obliged to pay you. I just want to get some clarity.
But they do pay. They do pay. Let me just clarify one thing. This target is actually having less to do with the standards. The standards are intact, but we've actually held back in putting them in the Gazette because we're still working on purifying them to make sure that they meet the practices that are happening elsewhere in the world in terms of the peer reviews that are involved in terms of what performance audit, how performance audit naturally should be done. So we are doing them now. We are participating in other peer reviews. We're happy that the way we're doing them is fine, but we just need to take some lessons learned from these peer reviews and align our standards so that the day we actually do performance audit on a bigger scale, we have clearly defined standards by which we do them. So the fact that we are 7% does not mean that we don't know how to audit them. It's basically a reflection of the themes that we've identified. They will only consume a certain percentage of our resources. I thought I picked up an overlap between the target here and the standard. The two are unrelated. Yeah.
So let us agree then that the issue of performance auditing, performance information auditing is one of the issues that this committee is going to track through and set for discussion for this coming year. I think it's going to be, should be a thorough and good engagement. And we'll start off with just the matter that was raised earlier on, and we're going to set aside time for discussion on that. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Stevens?
Chair, I just want to mention the fact about that we should be consulted before any standards can be issued.
That's your legal opinion.
Well, it's a prima facie opinion because I haven't been able to, but it seems on the face of it quite obvious actually that it should be, because all this is part one of chapter 3. Now, section 11 says this part applies to all audits of auditees which the Auditor General must perform and offer to perform. That's 11. And this whole part, namely part one of chapter 3, refers to that. And you will see both section 20, section 13, all of them refers to section 11, in other words. So, yes, they are not mutually exclusive, they are mutually inclusive. So it would include performance audit standards.
I hear what you're saying, but I think I'd just like to ask Dalwood just to check on that, the whole procedure. I think, let me just say in conclusion, so that we don't stand this too long, it's just vital that the Auditor General's office is protected in terms of auditing standards. Because if you cannot refer to a standard or at least a procedure in which, a standard procedure in which you approach performance auditing and you leave yourself wide open for attack, for criticism, and for us just to protect the reputation of the Auditor General's office, we need that kind of
independence.
Yeah, and the independence, and your independence. Okay. Are we covered then with performance information and performance auditing? John, is there anything you want to add on?
No.
Okay. All right. Then, it's the two secondary focus areas, learning and growth. We've covered that in quite a lot of detail this morning. Let me just say that table 22. Although it gives us some details, it still doesn't give us some information, of the details of just your training program and its success and otherwise, and what is invested in it and what we're getting out of that. My disquiet also arises in that, as I said earlier on, in the financial statements, there's reference to the poor results a low pass rate. And this is on page 67, note 4. It's referring, it's a note 4 explaining a reference to the comparison of actual results with the approved budget. I don't want to go into details. In previous audit meetings, we went into enormous details about how many students passed and how many were in this category and how many in that category. I don't want us to do that now. But I think we need a little bit more information when we table our annual report on just the success of your investment in learning. Mr. Nomere, do you have anything to say?
Chair, we'll certainly do that. It's just that the manner in which we positioned the learning and growth here was based on the ultimate qualifying statistics. In other words, not people that are still in the pipeline, but people that have finished their studies. Now, based on that, the request that is being made is going to take us to a situational report about each and every layer of students that are studying. But we can find a holistic way of reporting on that without getting into too much details. In other words, the output based reporting versus because the others are still part of the input into the final deliverable. And I think we did say in the last session that we spoke about in purifying this measure that we need to give the committee the ultimate target that we want to achieve, that we're working towards, and then we can report against that from time to time. I don't know whether that will that will address the situation here.
Are people happy to confirm this approach? Okay. All right, then my remarks remain subject to what you've now said. Okay, can we then move then on to operational excellence? Now, how does Mr. Stevens manage to get his pen hooked into his glasses in that way? Okay. Operational excellence, using the CSA tool, applying it to yourself. And we've got your results in Table 24. Dr. Woods.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. I just kind of helpful to get a bit more information on the methodology, because it seems to be quite a subjective methodology. I think that's what the chairperson hinted that is wrong. You talk about maturity of processes. How do you measure these things? How do you establish the yardsticks against which you measure your performance here? Just if you could help me with the understanding.
I wouldn't say the methodology is subjective. I would say the methodology is self-assuring. Because here we're intending to encourage the management team to take primary responsibility for controls and not depend on auditors to come and tell them about the status of their control environment. However, we do have a more objective way of confirming that what management are saying on a monthly basis is indeed authentic. When the auditors go there, internal auditors and external auditors, they do validate the correctness of the self-assessment results. And, I mean, up to now, we've picked up very little deviations between the self-assuring results and the independently checked results by either the internal and external auditors. So that's the way it works. That's the way it works. In terms of the details of what exactly happens
it's a simple process of defining what the control procedure should be. And then the next layer of that process is identify what questions should management respond to monthly to confirm that they have actually complied with the established controls. And those questions, as described somewhere in this document, are the ones that between either yes or no, which we basically need to have more yeses than no. There's no not applicable. And the target for the control self-assessment, which is not here but it's in the detail, is that for the department to business unit to be considered to have done what is expected, it should actually have no less than 90% of yeses in any 1 month. So we do expect a high level of compliance at the self-assuring level, which is subsequently validated by the auditors. I don't know whether I know I've given a bit of a superficial explanation of the process, but in a nutshell, it's basically saying, it's doing what everyone else is doing, but it's saying you have questions not more than 5 that you need to respond to that are focused on key controls. And if those questions are answered to the affirmative, then you know that controls are intact.
I may just follow up, Jenny. When I see the heading here, operations excellences as it pertains to process, to me this stands up as a big area. This is about all your operational processes. So this is one of the big performance areas. And this is your annual report for the public to understand and digest. Now, maybe I'm just a bit slow, but I read through this a couple of times, and there seems to be a fair amount of jargon about the system you're using, which keeps referring to the maturity of processes. I have a vague understanding from previous discussion, but I'm not sure that other people would. But coming to the end of this section, I'm trying to say, so did they do well or badly? And I can't quite work it out. So I don't know if it couldn't just be a little more friendly or maybe a little bit described in a bit different way.
So as I understand it, the capability maturity model is a model which you use, the Auditor General's office uses to evaluate its auditees. And now it has turned that model on itself and saying we're looking at that model and how we stand up to it. Okay. The person in the street, I'm not sure if they understand. But I think people do understand. And for me, when I look at this, I see level one, a number of business processes. And you can refer to, I think the previous Auditor General's report, where the Auditor General, I've got it here, the capability maturity model, where you have level one, the startup level, where no proper control frameworks exist, level two, where proper internal framework is developed, level three. The Auditor General has in the past provided us with details of this gap, which we could probably make available if you don't have it. Yes, it's not a few, but I think from their point of view, they have provided us with that information. And what seems to be coming out here is that 19% of their business processes is still on level one. Then you go to level two, level three. Now, it's level three, because that's... Mm-hmm? Level three is halfway. And level two? Yes. Ah. And I thought level three was... Is it? Yes, that's right. Level 5, 5, and 6. Well, thank you. Now I see what you're saying. Because in terms of your own capability maturity model, it goes from level 1 to level 6. And here we only have reportings on level 1 to level 3. Now, are we referring to the same thing or aren't we? Yes, that's the question,
yeah.
Now, can we just get an answer on this?
Are these the same standards?
Are these the same standards that are applied to your auditees?
Well, not standards,
the maturity capability level or whatever. Yeah, the capability maturity model.
Actually, they're exactly the same. What we've done on our side, I do concur, we may need to put this in a much more simpler kind of format. But the way we've applied it to ourselves, we've said that operational excellence has got to be embedded in the business processes that are clearly defined and complied with. So everything that we do has got to be properly defined and complied with. Now, our own interpretation in terms of our system is that unless something has got a controlled self-assessment mechanism, we cannot be assured that it actually has got a sustainable compliance level. And so that's why our level 1 to 3 is based on the extent to which we have developed clearly defined procedures, developed clearly defined questions for management to answer those questions on a monthly basis. Now, we are ramping up to that level where only financial and systems-based controls, that's why only 3 here, have reached that level of maturity. But those non-financial practices, which is why we've got 19 processes, have not as yet reached that level. So we're now working on the non-financial areas of our business, the processes, so that even those, when we talk about, for instance, the question of leadership, we can be able to say, how do you know that our leadership practices are sound? We should be able to measure and test the extent to which everyone complies with the leadership standards that have been defined. We're not there yet. So that's the way we interpret this. Now, how we apply it to the government departments, we apply it only to, at the moment, financial practices. As far as financial practices, we're already at level 3. But on non-financial, we're still working on getting to level 3. But we'll put this in a much more simpler context in the future so that it's understood better.
You came up at this time of the day and this time at this level of exhaustion because I do think it requires much more engagement.
This really concerns me because I couldn't understand this level 1, 2, 3. I thought this should have been level 3, 4, 5 or 4, 5, 6, you know, because you've got to your level 3, as you said. And I think when you have, as a SCOPA member, I would be horrified to look at this. I wouldn't believe it. It could be possible. So I think that, you know, the wrong message being sent out here. I don't know what to do about that. I think it's quite wrong here.
I think the answer to that is to respond to an earlier question where we need to specify what these 19 risk areas are.
Yeah.
Then we can say the 3 that are still at level 1 are X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
And for that, we have not even started defining the management or even the strategy as to how we're going to deal with them. That's why we're putting them at level 1. But the other ones, we've got some strategy, but we don't test compliance in a systematic way. That's why we say they are level 2. But for the financial ones, we've gone beyond just having processes, but testing that on a self-assessment basis.
On this, Gavin? No, we're on process. Yes, carry on.
Thanks. Yeah, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been under the impression for a couple of years that corporate services was maybe a disaster area, is too big, too serious way to describe it, but that you had a number of problems, and you even refer here to, I think, the slowness of the restructuring process. I'm sure that must be quite disruptive in a way to the organization. So perhaps if you could just elaborate a little on your report here and just where you referred to in your last sentence, ongoing feedback to this committee. Perhaps you could just give us a little bit of feedback now to just hopefully assure us that this important division of your organization is basically restructured.
Yeah,
Chair, certainly we had a clear milestone that by November this year we need to have learned all the lessons emanating from the restructuring of corporate services. And indeed, we have restructured initially in 2005, I think, when we brought that to the committee as part of our annual report, sorry, strategic plan. That resulted in a spike in our budget. We have since then learned a couple of lessons from that exercise, and we've even went back and remodified even that structure. To the extent that where we stand now, we're happy that the current model and the current structure that we have in corporate services is optimal enough to service the business. And in the strategic plan that will be discussed in the next few weeks, I do think that we'll really unpack the journey that we've traveled in so far as that's concerned and where we stand now and why we believe we are comfortable that that structure is able to deliver. Because if it does not deliver now, it will be a question of personalities not performing, not a structural defect, which we had before. And we can deal with personalities much simpler than a structural defect. That then puts us in a situation where we're now able to say, having dealt with corporate services in this way, how well are we structured in so far as the audit business is concerned now? And these are the areas where we'll be reflecting on as well in the next few weeks when we talk about the strategic plan. So that we don't fix corporate services and we still have structural flaws on the audit side, whether at the leadership level or whether at the number of people that we need to do the audit properly. So we've looked at our assumptions along those lines to say, optimally to do this audit effectively, what kind of resources do we need? So we've looked at it in that respect, yeah. But as far as corporate services, maybe JG can confirm, we're happy that the structurally we have reached the optimal level.
Thanks. Chair, I think on the side of corporate services, we have done recently what we've referred internally as aligning functions, because we've looked at what we already had arising from the restructuring, and we basically specifically looked critically at the key functions within corporate services and tried to pull together those that we believe work well together as part of their servicing of the audit business. So in the detailed plan going forward, we are going to be able to share with you how we've done that. And of course, I'm sure it was reflected in the annual report that we now have a permanent chief operations officer who's purely looking after the corporate services environment and making sure that areas like information and communication technology, areas like finance and human capital and those areas are geared towards providing services broadly to the whole organization as well as to the audit business in particular. One of the examples I could share amongst others in doing that was that when we were embarking on this major recruitment exercise, every time you engage with the people in audit, they will say, we are at the beck and call of human capital, which is corporate services, in order for us to get the required skills that we need. But the reality is that human capital is only providing the audit business some level of support towards audit division achieving their objective. For example, the whole process of doing an evaluation and assessment of the suitability of a candidate requires a trained auditor to be able to take on that process. And over a period of time, there's been a blurred line of responsibility with regard to that. Now, the people in corporate services know exactly what the start and the end point is in the process of assisting the audit business in getting skills on board. It's not their full responsibility from beginning to end. Those are issues that we are now beginning to clarify so that there can be ongoing support from within the organization so that we can realize the objectives of the restructuring as we go forward. So, in essence, I think what's going to be reflected in the strategic plan document is the whole issue of bedding down what we have and making sure that we sweat the assets that we've created over a period of time to make sure that there's proper focus on the things that will make a difference from the broader audit business.
Well, think you will recall how many times we asked for an update on corporate services restructuring, and I'm very, very pleased, and I really mean this, that it seems to be getting better down now. Gives us comfort that the audit teams are getting the backup that is required. Yes, definitely. Debt collection, we've covered. Oh, yes, Mr. Johnson.
I was trying to check financials whether we have committed any resources on this restructuring on corporate services. As you are correctly pointing out, this has been a matter that has been there for long. I would imagine in that instance, therefore, funds that have been allocated at some point. Whether we did commit and to what an extent have we gone. I think at some point, so the budget of about 25, we should commit it in this regard. If you could comment on that.
I think that number would not come as a single line item. The only spike I recall on corporate services was the human resource investment that we needed to make in increasing the number of people within corporate services. Other than that, I can't recall that there was a specific number related to restructuring. The only time when we had a number of that nature was a year before, I think it was two or five or so, when the restructuring was still in progress, and we did not have an indication as to what that number would be. So we made a broad provision then, but we've since moved away from that broad provision here.
Just to add, Chair, to that, in terms of the 2006-07 year, as disclosed on the comparison of the budget, what has come through is probably the last bit of cost that would have been flowing through from the previous year. And I can say categorically that in terms of the plan going forward for the 2007-08 year, there is no cost budgeted for restructuring going forward. So whatever was identified and spent in the year before this one has gone through the system, and there's no expectation that there's more that's going to be spent in the following year's budget. So effectively, everything that is happening in bedding down those structures is a business as usual ongoing operating cost.
Can we then move on? Sorry.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm coming back to this morning. I think it's picked up to me in a quite interesting aspect. The last two items on the primary budget. So I don't think it's especially the second one. And that would be, because I don't quite understand this, and I would really like to make you understand how it works in the business. It has to do with the mission of the division, that's your 4 to 5. I'm not saying we should have a long discussion of any series, but just to get some idea, but I don't know that you what it means, but just of the group. You understand, but I don't know what they mean by reputation index baseline. I mean, I don't know what a reputation is, and I've read your report, but I don't know what
okay. Index. We're referring to page, the last two items for discussion, page 29 and 30, leadership effectiveness and reputation. Yes. No, you're absolutely right. Thank you for drawing our attention. Just for members, remember there was a question about leadership, and you had found that the model that you were using was an inadequate model, and you reworked the model that you used to look at leadership. And I presume that this is the new model that you were using. Is that right? Okay.
Once again, we can improve on the wording of this explanation here, but in a sense, what this is saying is, how are we going to measure the effectiveness of our leadership, in the case of leadership effectiveness, and how are we going to measure the effectiveness of our relationship with stakeholders?
to the extent that they collectively, that is the reputation now, can actually say that the AG is living up to its mandate,
yeah,
or to its reputation promise. Hence the reference to the reputation promise in the beginning here. Yeah. Now, when you put together this target, you said we need to establish a baseline test. Where are we in the first instance? And last year, an extensive amount of survey was run to establish what the stakeholders think of us as living up to our constitutional mandate. And the results of this are that we came out at a level of 19% from the survey. And the benchmark for companies that are doing well on the reputation index is 40%. So about half of where best performing companies are. And the basis of that index is based on how many people are rating us at the top end of the survey questions. In other words, those that believe that we're doing excellent or very good in whatever we do. There are people that are sitting in the middle tier of their satisfaction level. Those, in terms of the standard of this methodology, are the ones that need to be moved to the high end of the responses. So to the extent that we've got people that are sitting there, we should not be too complacent.
Yeah.
What obviously is not required is people that are sitting in a totally disagreeing position about how they believe we're actually living up to our responsibility. So it's a methodology that's seeking to understand people's perceptions, a perception-based thing, so that we don't disregard those perceptions. Now, the action that is required to deal with those issues then will be driven by the analysis that the service provider that we use will do to say the reason it's sitting at 19% is because there are these drivers of perception which we need to take into account. One of those drivers is the visibility of the leadership within the office. It was felt that we're not visible enough, and that's why when we conducted this survey, the intention was to interview about 100 people, but 10,000 calls were logged to get to speak to 100 people in the, as part of the general public.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because you need to cross the first question before the interview can proceed. Do you know who the auditor general is? If the answer is no, then you actually move on. So that's the extent of how people understand who we are. And we need to actually reduce that level of misunderstanding of what this organization is about. So those are some of the issues and useful feedback that is driving this issue. Internally within staff, I mean, there were critical issues that needed to be addressed, for instance. The issue of performance management practices, compensation management practices within the office. Those are the top two issues that drove and influenced by and large this reputation index. Yeah. And interestingly enough, the third issue in the order of priority was the issue of corporate social responsibility by the office. Staff felt that they don't hear a lot about what the office does to contribute towards society. And it's a question of whether is it something that's not happening or is something that people are not aware of.
But you know,
it's a communication issue within the organization.
But look, it might be a communication issue, but taking a model that is based in the private sector and applying it to yourself, in this particular instance of this last factor that you mentioned of what you are contributing in terms of corporate social responsibility. Okay, corporate social responsibility can mean a lot of things. I mean, from welfare programs right through to socially responsible investing. But you as an institution are probably, together with the judiciary, with the media, with parliament, with the prosecuting authority, whatever, are the key institutions of democracy. And so just your very mission, your mission in itself is indispensable for democracy. So your call, the social, your social responsibility is huge, but your contribution is huge at the same time. You can't almost, we can't expect the Auditor General's office to be engaged in a whole lot of social responsibility programs. Doing your job is your call to social responsibility. And that, interestingly, then shows your own staff members' lack of understanding of how critical your institution is for democracy.
Now that's
interesting.
Yeah.
Workshop
that. Yeah, that is why I thought it was so critical, because wherever I go, and my experience, limited as it is in scope and so on, there is only praise for the office of our Auditor General in Africa and in Australasia, and wherever you go, we are highly regarded as an institution. If you look at the report of Dr. Osman, Professor Osman, of all the Chapter 9 institutions, he praises the Auditor General. Now why? Because he has interior academics and he has an intimate knowledge of what they do. And so that is why I was a little bit shocked. Somehow we're not sending out the right message to Jan Public, if I could call it this, which comes to your point that confidence in the office of the Auditor General is critical to our country's democracy. And I think we're not criticizing it. I think you've got to do something about it. I don't know what. Instead, we have a role to play as a committee.
Mm.
I think that there has been an upsurge in the culture in recent times on television. There's quite frequently now we get the hearings of Skype, but I don't think it focuses on the Auditor General, what they do. It's more,
Well, I would be interested to know, because I know that you go into any municipality, you go anywhere, and I know my own constituency. You talk about the Auditor General, people know. They know that that's a watchdog, and they know that someone should be feared, too. There is a good understanding of that. There might not be an intimate understanding of what the Auditor General does. And I suppose we've got different views, and we're getting different things. I, myself, would not be happy with a proactive campaign to market the Auditor General. I think the Auditor General markets itself as an institution by the quality of the work that they do and the respect that they're held in. Once you start going into spin and start going into those kind of things, then you denigrate yourself, So, I'm not sure that I agree with Mr. Trent on this, but certainly I think you people will be analyzing your reputation index and be informing us on what you think are the weaknesses and strengths of it.
You also come home
again,
and that's the
thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to agree with you. It would be a denigration to have a marketing. But on the other hand, the type of work by its essence of what the office does is low profile work. It's backroom stuff. And it would not be wrong, in my view, if we could lift the profile of his work. Now, it does get lifted through the reports that SCOPA gets. SCOPA quite often gets a lot of press. But I think we must probably find a way of just lifting, not marketing, but lifting the profile of the results and the importance of the work that is done by the AG. That surely can't be wrong.
For me, I don't argue with the end objective. It's how you achieve that objective. Looking at profile, for instance, if you're looking at local municipalities, local government, just a question that local government is now expected to set up scopers. Now, I know how Teng went through a process of trying to assist the municipalities of setting up scopers. Because my experience has been, as soon as you've got an active scoper, immediately enhances the standing of an Auditor General, because you then get that engagement of civil society, of your local councillors. And so, look, I think this is a discussion that we should be having this year, of just the reputation of the Auditor General and engaging with the Auditor General on this issue. But I think it's almost, you raise the profile by the work that you do and the exposure that you get to work that you do, rather than just trying to artificially get the Auditor General to be commenting on talk shows or, you know, that kind of nonsense. Because that's, you know, we don't want jet set auditors, you know. We don't want bling. We don't want, you know, the bling of an auditor, you know, Auditor General bling. That's the last thing we want.
Yeah, Instead,
it's like
the scorpion. How can you promote the scorpion? Because nobody wants to hear about
that. Yes, well, let's not get into matters related to your province, shall we? Mr. Nomeme?
I think the comments are very useful because they do confirm the outcome actually of this survey, because as I say, externally the main issue is about the leadership visibility, and that leadership visibility can be achieved in many ways through, once we've done our report, how do we then make sure that our report gets acted upon, how do we make sure that people understand our report, and also the communication of what and who we are, what we're about and who we are, without sort of bells and whistles, but that's the basic communication here.
Servicing of engaging the people that you need to be.
Yeah.
And certainly the challenge is local government. You know, we've been able to manage national and provincial government, legislatures, but it's local government that's the next big challenge. Okay, are we covered then? I always look at Mr. Kent because he always comes up with more questions. And Mr. Johnson's got a little question. He says it's this week.
The 19% reputation index. We did dwell on this in our last session. I think the issue really shouldn't be so much about measuring the office with a norm, that is what, 40% thing?
Yeah.
Because of the nature of the issues they're dealing with in this office and the challenges they're confronting. I think we need to, I'm not sure what metrics, you know, you have in the equation here that ultimately end up with the 19%. Maybe at two levels. On one level, whether is the office happy with the results on one hand. On the other hand, I guess another question for us is whether are we happy? As I was saying, it also borders very much on what is it that we expect. We don't expect much from those from, if you like, the auditees. Because they really are not going to be having much, you know, nice to say. Precisely because of the nature of work that is there. Maybe it's something that we might wish to, at some point, need to engage further in. Both from where you are seated and also from where we are seated as well. So as to understand precisely what is it that we want to achieve. When you talk about such an index, we're not going to be excited about, we are probably not unhappy about the fact that it is 19, which is almost, you know, half, you know, below the norm that is there. Something I thought we might wish to look into as we move forward.
I would absolutely agree with you that the reputation, the protection of the reputation of the Auditor General's office is one of our mandates in the committee, and we need to do it. Eddie, last question.
In Canada, which is where I had the privilege of being, the Auditor General has, on a regular basis, a press conference when they release, like, your audit outcomes. Not with Scopa, a press conference at the Auditor General, and they have that, all the media, the television, and they spend 2 hours, and it gets high profile on national television, and the people in Canada are very aware of the value of what the Auditor General's office does for them in terms of, and of course, they do, at this stage, they've possessed due performance auditing, and there's a lot of discussions about whether they're getting value for their money, the taxpayers' money. I'm not saying that the Auditor General must become a movie star, but I really think, and I think Tennis's idea of having roadshows, I think is an excellent idea, but you need a public relations, not only a human resource manager.
I think that is a useful suggestion, actually having a press conference. The press are incredibly interested. You saw their turnout just to hear your, you know, just to hear the review of your thing. And I think just somebody sober speaking to the press is very useful. Yeah. So we don't have the Sinal member there because he's not sober.
Yes, indeed. The way the roadshows have been planned, the plan first that we'll have three sessions, for instance, for this year, for the general report. In one day, one session will brief the staff that has worked hard to actually deliver the results, to see the fruits of their sweat. And then we'll move on from there to brief the press. We'll spend an hour with the press. And then after that, obviously under embargo, so that the press understands clearly what the context of what's contained in the report is, for accurate reporting. And then after that, then move to the legislature. Then, so if there's anything that's been missed during the press conference, then the press can pick it up during the deliberations in the legislature through parliament.
It puts you under enormous personal stress because you're on the roadshow quite a lot, but I think it will do a lot for the organization. Okay. Can we then just go on to the financials? The financials are dealt with by the audit committee generally, and I mean, it's just for us to comment on matters, you know, we don't have to go too intensively. If there are matters that the audit committee wants to report to draw attention, they can do so. They haven't this time around. But Dr. Woods?
Ma'am, would you allow me to make a final comment as we move to the next session? I found this section very, very useful on the performance side of things. I think at the time we've identified all of your critical areas very well, and the amount of information you've given us. So I think as a document, your main accountability document, was highly appropriate and just very, very useful and a real pleasure compared to many of the departmental reports which are very sparse on performance. Today's business plan refers to this new international accounting standard public sector requirement of your annual report containing your detailed income statement against your budget and more an encouragement of greater explanations on variances, which I see you do at the end. You give a bit of information. But a lot of your performance reporting starts to tie in, links up to a number of those variances. So I think you have the basis of you actually being ahead of the game of what the international developments are. So I'd just like to say congratulations.
Yeah.
A very, very, very small issue. Throughout your performance report, wherever you put down your actual result, you put it in your right-hand column. So if it's target, you put target, then you put actual. Or you put budget, then you put actual. And take 35 as a result. Which I find is the wrong way around. When you move to your financials, you get it the right way around. So you put actual, then you put compared to previous year on the left side. Or when you get to the budget and the final part, you put budget on the right hand side. So it throws on that a gear a bit.
So this is a small issue for next time if you would consider it, please.
The person here who's got left, right hand problems. So we'll have consistency in reporting. I think any matters that a person wants to, I think we take note of the deficit. It has reduced from last year, but it's still worrisome that it's not. We're not performing according to budget. And we know that your retained reserves are now decreasing. Your retained income is decreasing as a consequence of the 2 years in which you're recording deficits. I'm not sure that you're going to get yourself out of the woods next year because of the amount of contract work that you're going to have to be doing. And the rejuvenating of the staff and getting the thing, I don't know.
Chair, thanks for picking up that point. We certainly think that we are not going to turn this situation around immediately. I don't think there's going to be a drastic turnaround to be fair on ourselves as well as I think on the level of transparency. I think it's important to note that the mix between filling up positions within our audit environment as well as engaging third-party audit firms is still going to be an issue we grapple with, which will take us a bit of time. So I think so far as the deficits are concerned and that type of stuff, we will certainly, and in fact we've engaged with that in the planning for 2007-08, to say that where we are forecasting for the end of this current financial year, we're likely to be in a similar position as we ended the previous year insofar as the deficits are concerned, but we're putting an effort into trying to manage that process as we go forward. I think the details we'll share with the members of the committee when we come around for the tabling of the budget and the strategic plan, but certainly we know we're near turning it around into a positive bottom line.
What implications does this have for long term on your bottom line? I'm just looking. I was doing a look at the reserves and the standing of the reserves, and most of your reserves remain constant. Your staff training or whatever you call it is now down to nil, and you're now going to incorporate it into your budget. Just what impact is this all going to have on your reserves? The budgeting for deficits, more or less.
I think the challenge we face with is the model of the business that we're running. It's a business that is run on very, very thin margins. Mm-hmm. I mean, any slight omission, it takes us straight into the red. Mm-hmm. Now, and that has also been the issue that has given rise to the retention of all the surpluses that this organization has done in the past years in order to finance the working capital, in order to finance the capital expenditure. So I think the funding model for this business is where we find ourselves in a very, very big quagmire. And we're not going to move away from that until such time as we relax the margins, which will have an impact on the cost of audit to the state. Obviously, one was not going to margin that total out of proportion. But just to make sure that we've got sufficient amount of cushion in the event we need to actually substitute the our own staff with the work that's done by the firm. Because the balance between those two is still very tight at the moment in a very volatile labor market. So I think that's the only solution we have, but the quantum of how much those margins should be sitting at is what is not clear at the moment. Perhaps we need to do some work along those lines.
It's worrying me that I don't see the long-term strategy there of just how we're going to be balancing this out. So I think we do need to work on that. Mr. McCready, did you want to say something? Yeah. Your general reserve remains constant at 116 million. And the auditor, the National Treasury has allowed you to retain surpluses in the past because they say that's part of their recapitalization. I'm just wondering if it's ever going to rise a point at which we will need a recapitalization, because we're not setting surpluses aside now. And, you know, I really do anticipate that this will receive a good amount of focus from yourselves in terms of long-term viability. My concern also arises is that we're putting, and many other institutions are putting you under pressure to increase your performance auditing, your performance information auditing. Now that is going to require different kinds of stuff. Not only auditors can do it in the traditional sense. You're also going to need policy analysts, a different range of personnel. If we are going to expand into that, the budgetary implications and the implications on the long-term viability, financial viability of the office, then really, really comes to the fore. And, you know, I would like, you know, this is this coming year that we're in, the year of 2008, is going to be really the last 18 months of this committee's life, and then we hand over to a next committee that comes in with the next parliament. And I do think that we need to have some understanding, not just medium term, but long term, where the Auditor General's office can realistically position itself around regulatory auditing, performance auditing, performance information auditing, and the financial resources to meet all of those requirements. But I'm not sure that we've got all of those together. I think partly because we haven't got performance information, auditing finalized, and, you know, those two aspects of our auditing responsibilities aren't bedded down. I just want to know, are these things that are you engaged in these kinds of discussions, or is it just the immediate short-term that is engaging you at the moment of, you know, of just meeting your state regulatory auditing requirements?
The discussions along the lines of the price have commenced just most recently in terms of us starting to look at what our capability is to be able to step up to the plate in terms of the expectations for issues around performance auditing and performance information. And the team that has been tasked with engaging on this issue has also started looking at what happens elsewhere on institutions similar to us who have already embarked on that road, just to pull together a context in terms of where we need to be going. And we've also, because of the gravity of the situation in terms of the sustainability of finances, within our team have pulled one of our corporate executives within the core audit environment to head up what we now refer to as an audit support environment, which has within it issues around audit strategy going forward into the future, which looks at issues around performance audits, amongst other things, as well as it is effectively the engine room within the audit environment that supports the key delivery arms of audits. And really the mandate for that particular role is to look further into the future with regards to the issues we need to be addressing now as a team within the audit business, to start understanding what the implications of developing a full-blown performance auditing environment has for us in terms of the skills that we need to be addressing, in terms of the dynamics of the profile of the office going into the future. So the initial steps have been taken, starting with assigning responsibility and starting to engage with our own numbers as we see them. And of course, one of the things that we've also started talking about is to engage with the committee on what our thoughts are in terms of one or more options that we can look at in order to address this situation. So as soon as I don't want to say it will be in the strategy document, but it will be in a document that will be taken through with the committee in due course.
Do they anticipate that you will recover all your performance auditing and performance information auditing costs from the auditee? Are you, you know, is that what you have in mind, or is that still to be discussed?
We haven't gone into any great detail on that. We certainly haven't applied ourselves in terms of the audit costs for performance auditing. There hasn't been an in-depth discussion on that.
Because, you see, that's going to be a question that government departments and municipalities and whoever is the auditee that is undergoing a performance audit. If we are now going to be increasing the audit fees in order to be doing these extended performance audits, we're going to have to engage with discussion with National Treasury. These implications have to become very clear. And, you know, it doesn't become mandatory that people pay these audit fees for performance auditing. All of these issues.
But it's
a statutory thing.
Yeah.
But up to now, I do not see when we impose audit fees. You know, like when we deal with performance information auditing, I'm not sure that we're recovering those costs from the particular department, even though we are still in phase one of it.
Yeah.
So if the habit starts to develop that departments think that performance information auditing fees are just part of the regulatory audit costs that are incurred, and if that practice starts to develop, we might get resistance from our auditees. But I mean, I don't think we need to discuss this, but I think these are issues. I think this last year was really the year of bedding down the corporate governance framework, bedding down a whole lot of just how we as a committee exercise oversight and whatever. And I think we've done well in that. I want to echo the comments made by Dr. Woods that, you know, this annual report is now really getting to where we can apply effective oversight because we understand what's going on here. I think this committee is going to be seized with the issue of performance information auditing, performance auditing, as a, well and above also what these other things. Not with the view of trying to pressurize you into leaping into this, but in asking the sober questions like these that we're asking now of how we move forward on this to make sure that the Auditor General's office remains sustainable.
And independent.
And independent, yes. Mr.
Nomeda,
and then I'll take in Mr.
McLaren. Chair, I do want to concur with Kimmy that your questions are very timely because the the remodeling of the audit business that is happening, and you will see in the strategy plan document, is meant at responding to exactly questions like those. Because, I mean, over and above, I'm sure it can give you the heads up on the key assumptions that we're thinking about. I think those key assumptions are to make sure that for the work that we do now on the regulatory audit, we've got sufficient capacity and resources to do that well so that we can get these qualifications that are widespread out of the way and be able to at least move the level of confidence on government to an acceptable level. But the second key assumption is to, in order for us to do that effectively, we need a dedicated focus for the audit business. And the superimposing over and above the key executives that are there, the head of audit, that will do nothing else but look at the auditing business. You know? So at the moment, you'll appreciate that if the deputy AG and AG have got to have their eyes cast on corporate services and something else, something falls between the cracks. And that's why the head of auditing is one of the additions to the model that has been thought about, precisely to be able to respond to questions like the one that I'm imagining at the moment. That naturally will be supported by the establishment of this audit support unit, whose sole purpose will be the think tank in terms of what auditing should be insofar as government auditing is concerned. So I think that level of capacity that we're creating for ourselves should be able to leave us with no excuse to say we actually still think about it or we think about it. So we'll be able to think ahead, which then puts us in a situation where in the 2010 strategic document we'll have
most of the responses to the expectations that are beginning to emerge. But I think next year's strategic plan will simply say this is the resource that we're providing for ourselves in order to respond proactively to these expectations and questions. So that will be the flavor, I would say, of the strategic plan that will be coming our way in the next few weeks.
I know that we don't have a specific focus for now, but whilst something that I might not be very close to understanding, one ends up thinking of something else. I was just trying to look, as you are talking about the issue of deficit and the future not being very bright in terms of turning around that situation, as to where do we put the situation of collection? I can understand that there's a report that says we've got bad debts. Now, the issue of collection, the strategy around collection, I do understand that we can have a document. But now, where you can budget and say, this is my plan, I'm intending collecting so much. I'm looking here, if the document is telling us about some money that are owed, that should have been paid by the 31st of March, 2006. But I'm not sure whether is this report the summary of the financial performances that include some of those money that have been owed to the department that are part of the income that we've got here. I'm trying to understand that, as if you know that in the next month you'll fall short, you start asking yourself, who's owing me some money? And probably even the value, because I can see the number of days, but I'm not sure how many millions are those.
Chair, we, as I indicated earlier, tried a number of options to try and maximize collection of our outstanding debt. As we prefer that our debtors be in the bank rather than be in the debtors account. We tried that, and we tried with, as I said earlier, in making reference to the Eastern Cape in terms of the challenges we face. One of the things we've done in our most recent bilateral with National Treasury, where we highlighted once again the issue that faces us with regards to outstanding debt. And they've kind of agreed to assist us, as they've been trying to do in the past. And one of the major challenges we face, amongst other things, which I think is linked, amongst others, also to the question of financial management capacity in those environments, we now ended up having to take this full list. I think it was adding up to somewhere around 80, 85 million that's outstanding right across the board, where we needed, on a specific item, on a specific local municipality, we needed to use our resources to say, please get hold of that municipality and confirm whether they do indeed have the invoices relating to the amount that is outstanding in our books. That was just the extent of the challenge that we faced. Because when National Treasury was handed the list by us, and they went to make representations on our behalf with those local municipalities, they got pushback to say, but this amount is inaccurate, this amount I don't know about. Now you can appreciate the extent of the challenge for us to then try to revalidate invoices that we know have been sent out to those municipalities and in terms of the fees that we are sending. So it's really a problem, and one of the things we kind of engaging on, because we're not going to let the matter, you know, because it introduces a number of issues as well. I mean, if you know that you are not going to be paid the fee, it introduces other behavior that's undesirable for an audit office. Amongst others, for example, it might increase the level of risk that you have to assume it in that environment, because people walk in there knowing that I'm just doing this as a 3D type of thing, I'm not going to get my cash, and then the focus tends to be diverted as well. We don't want that to happen. We want to make sure that if there's an agreement in terms of the recovery of fees, that it happens. So one of the proposals we were talking about with National Treasury, and it's still very early stages in terms of how we've developed it, is to look at, for example, the suggestion that was made earlier to say all local governments have budget items on their budgets. they all know that it is mandatory that they must be audited. So, if the funds have been approved in terms of vote, they are available for that service. If it's 100 bucks, certainly 70 bucks of that can be ring-fenced in anticipation of a payment of the audit fee when the audit is done. So that the Auditor General is then occupied with worrying about collecting the other 30 bucks. That type of consideration is one of the issues that we, rather than us having to chase the full 100 rands and take a lot of time trying to get it, when we know that it was approved as part of the package of approving the local government budget, we'd rather try and work on a situation where we get that fee from a source other than the local government if they are going to have problems with invoices. But we haven't tested that proposal as a solution, but we are looking at that as one of many proposals that we can try and drive quick turnaround time in terms of the number of days. So the 115 days that are reflected on the report, we have an analysis that is given on note 23.2 of the annual financial statement, which draws attention to the type of amount on page 2 at the top, the type of amounts that remained outstanding at the end of the past financial year. If you look at the column between 30 to 120 and more, totaling somewhere around 60 million in total for all categories. But the biggest one certainly is no doubt the local sphere. And just to add to that, what we also experienced is that because of some of the ongoing costs that we have to incur, and we obviously pay upfront for payroll-related costs prior to collecting the invoice once we deliver the work, what it has meant, amongst other things, and for the first time, I guess, we had to dip into some of our investment resources with TIC, meaning that we are using our past resources that we kept to try and finance ongoing working capital. And it's extremely dangerous to be in that position because it just is a red flag, I think, that needs to be given clear attention. And we are, in fact, on our side, giving attention to it, but I think we'll come to make a presentation to the committee when we present our business plan as well. But certainly it's a significant challenge for us to continue to manage ongoing basis.
So, Shabby, just wanted to finish on a new Mr. James, yeah?
No, Madam Chair, I was just thinking that maybe we hope that the discussion that we're going to have with treasurers try and have some sort of strategy would assist in this regard. But the one is that sometimes it's very awkward to find that sometimes people forget that it's the same government who gives them the money, the grant that they get, they come from the same government. But on the other hand, they don't want to pay what is due to the same government that they own. They're getting millions of rands from the state, but they don't want to pass over what needs to be passed over. For instance, in conditions of, in respect of the receiver of revenue, where you'll find that if you want to go for tendering, and the companies will say proof that you are paying your dues. Now, even in this instance, local government, each and every 2 months, they submit claims to SARS for VAT claims, and they get those money. I think some of the things that could be done where they'll have to prove that they are not owing anything to the government before they can be passed over what is due to them. Some of these things need to be looked upon, including putting in interest on whatever they owe you.
The constitutional problems that National Treasury had in terms of withholding funds to another sphere of government, and that has always been one of the biggest stumbling blocks. But I'm glad to, because you can't withhold money from another sphere of government once it's been voted. But I'm glad to hear that you are in discussion with National Treasury on this issue, and I look forward to just hearing what results come through. I think we need to speak to our NCOP colleagues, particularly Mr. Tutu Khalani, because when they hold their oversight meetings, when they call in local governments and whatever, and speak to provinces, one of the issues that should be a standing thing, have you paid your audit fees?
Yeah.
and what is the state, and then speak to MECs for local government to keep a check on audit fees that are being paid. It's a huge problem. Mr. Trent?
Just three things quickly. The first is CFMA is going to be under revised quite. So I think these are issues that we can also take up in that process. Okay. Because it's prescribed that the audit must be done, therefore, and surely that act also should be playing some role to make sure that the costs are covered. Yes, and then the other question, the second point I want to make, I really want to congratulate the AG on their notes to the financials. I always find that very useful if you can have explanations, and generally, you know, I think everything is explained pretty clearly to us. And I think that's very useful. And just lastly, you spoke about the static reserves in some instances. The Special Audit Services Reserve, which is standing at 5.27 million, and I don't know for how long, but certainly for the last 2 years. And then I want to, that's on page 54. And I want to go to page 58 in the notes, it would be note 17. And then you say the contract worth irrecoverable. Now, is there any connection between that or not? That's the first question. The second question is, Chair, I noticed that that 5.27 was capped by the Audit Commission, on which you served, and that it should be revised. And I shouldn't like the Auditor General to be in a position, because if you read what that money, you know, what that reserve is for, to me, very important. The reserve is, this amount was kept for further guidance to provide for other financial to set aside to finance special investigations or audits for which the Auditor General may not be able to recover the cost. To me, that is critical. And I want to repeat what I said earlier. By spending money on those sort of reports, we are actually saving money, saving the government money. If you took a look at the housing report, the irregularities that were picked up with that audit, if they are corrected, will save the state literally hundreds of millions of rand. So I think that that's an area where the Auditor General must feel comfortable that if I have to do a special audit and I can't recover the money, that my reserves will be adequate. So maybe we should, in the course of this coming year, just interrogate for the next budget to see whether that's adequate.
Well, for the next budget and strategic plan, I don't know if you've revisited this amount, and I made the recommendation that amount be increased for special audits. But maybe that is something that you would like to look at and see. Yeah. Okay, well, I think we've come to the end of a long, exhausting day. I can see it's getting towards the end of the year. I think we all need a bit of a holiday at the moment. But I'd like to thank the Auditor General's Office for this report, this annual report, and for the engagement which we've had. I'd like to congratulate you, too, for the quality of work that you do and the commitment that you have to making sure that we have good quality audits and reliable audits and in the environment in which you are operating at the moment. I think we're very pleased to see the appointment of a Deputy Auditor General, because the present Auditor General has been carrying one hell of a load. I don't know how you've managed it all these months, just carrying the load on your own. And so what our plan is now is that we'll draw up the annual report, our report in the annual report. I think you have an idea of which way we are going. We will then engage with your strategic plan and budget on the 31st of October, the 31st of October, and then we will approve both our reports on the annual report and the strategic plan by, I think it's the 8th of November, 7th of November. So then you'll have feedback from us, and we'll be in the proper time for the legislative requirements. So, and thank you, members, for all the preparation and all the work and the engagement. And then we'll see you on the 31st of October. Okay.
Jim, I'd just say to thank you for the way you run these meetings. I think it's, you do extremely well, and you prepare yourself also on top of the issues. And to our support staff, David, I really feel sorry for you trying to get us together. It's a mission. But we appreciate what you do. And,
All right, then we can adjourn. Thanks very much. Yeah.